You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In 2003, after patients started coming into New York's Bellevue Hospital claiming that, much like the main character in Peter Weir's movie The Truman Show, their lives were being filmed and broadcast around the world, Dr. Joel Gold, a clinical associate professor of psychiatry at the NYU School of Medicine, started to take note. And he and his brother Ian Gold, an associate professor of psychology at McGill University, began to investigate how culture and social environments shape mental illness. And now they have co-authored a book based on their findings called Suspicious Minds, How Culture Shapes Madness, The Truman Show Delusion, and Other Strange Beliefs. It's published by Free Press. Very pleased to welcome Joel and Ian Gold to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for having us.
Good to be with you.
Joel, Bellevue's psychiatric ward is world famous. How many patients would you see on a daily basis?
It's variable. In the emergency room, we might see 30 patients upstairs on one of the units, depending on how many were admitted. It could be anywhere from 0 to 5 coming in new, and then there were about 28 patients on a unit at any given time.
Working there, you say it's difficult to see the mad forest for the delusional trees. What finally tipped you off about this Truman Show pattern?
You know, we see so many unusual ideas and delusions at Bellevue that it's hard to pick on one and say, wow, this is different from all the others. And it took probably 2, 3, maybe even 4 of these gentlemen who all said, my life is a reality television show, before I had the sense that this was unusual. This wasn't the, you know, run-of-the-mill odd belief.
Did you learn that all of them had seen the movie?
Only 3 of them mentioned the Truman Show by name. The other 2, it echoed the elements of the Truman Show. It's interesting. A couple of them definitely connected the movie to their experience. Others, not so much. They knew that their experience echoed the film.
When someone comes in with a delusion like that, were you prepared at the start? Did you have some treatments in mind?
When someone has a delusion, the reality is we treat them for whatever delusion they happen to be having. At Bellevue, it's an acute setting, so we really do want to get a handle on it. We don't really have, unfortunately, the time to get into the nitty-gritty of their long-term beliefs.
Ian, how long after Joel started treating these patients did he start telling you about them?
I remember it being about 2 years. He was home for a visit. I work in Montreal, and he was home for a visit, and we were having dinner together. And he was, as he often did, telling me about some of the stranger beliefs that he had encountered. And he said, oh, you should hear about this one, and told me about these patients and asked me if I'd read any papers about it. Delusion is sort of my primary area of research. And so I was surprised I'd never heard about it. And we looked into it together and discovered no one had talked about it.
You're a philosophy professor. How is delusion your primary area of research?
Oh, it's a long story, but philosophers are still generalists by nature, and we work on all sorts of things. Delusions are strange beliefs, and belief is one of the central topics in the discipline of philosophy known as epistemology, which is the theory of knowledge, of what we know, how we know it, what we believe, and how we come to believe things. And so delusions are pathological forms of the thing that we are generally interested in epistemology.
If there hadn't been a film like The Truman Show, do you think that these people would have just found another movie or book that would have inspired their delusions?
I think the answer must be yes. We really know nothing about the extent to which culture or environmental influences might make someone ill who would otherwise not be ill in some other environment. So we have to set that problem aside for the time being. But when people become ill, they have to express their strange beliefs in some way or other. And we know from a long history in psychiatry, over 200 years, that people will turn to whatever is around in the culture that captures the feeling or the ideas that they have. In particular, there's a long tradition, right back to the very beginning of case studies in psychiatry, in which patients will appeal to new technologies to express their delusions. So 200 years ago, people believed that they were being manipulated and persecuted by magnetic machines, when animal magnetism was the new science. And now we suspect that people are being persecuted or believe they're being persecuted by surveillance technologies.
I remember during the McCarthy era, some people talking about how their houses were bugged and that the FBI was selling it to people to make movies and television shows from their lives. And it was kind of crazy stuff. And my first thought was not delusion, but rather paranoid fantasy. Is there a link between the two?
Well, there are a lot of interesting links going on right now. You know, in this case, it's hard to tell people when they say the government is listening to our phone calls, they're checking our emails. It's not a delusion anymore.
Whereas, with a collection of metadata and,
exactly,
and the Snowden revelations.
PRISM, even the Patriot Act. It's very hard when a patient comes in and says these very things, I'm being monitored by the government, to say, you know, maybe there's something going on psychiatrically, when they can just bring in the cover of the New York Times and say, hey, doc, you claim that I've got an issue. Well, you know, maybe you're the crazy one.
Well, then you have to separate the two, don't you? There are people probably who would have valid concerns along those lines.
Absolutely. And it's important to tease apart the things that are real from those that are not. And if someone simply has that belief or that knowledge, as you and I have, we certainly wouldn't consider it a delusion. But if someone has other symptoms or it's more of a bizarre nature, then we start thinking about it more as a delusion.
Were patients responding to Jim Carrey's character in The Truman Show or the broader cultural shifts that were happening around them?
I think part of the movie that struck a chord was the blandness of the character, Jim Carrey's character, Truman Burbank.
It's the only time that Jim Carrey has ever kept himself under control.
There you go. He is so bland, and yet the whole world is watching him. And when you look at reality television, most of these people don't have particularly interesting lives. So if someone has the feeling that they're being watched, I've had that experience where people have told me, you know, why would anyone want to watch me? My life is boring. But then they see something like the film or these other people on YouTube who are, you know, juggling cats. They don't have any particular skill, beauty, anything that would have given them fame 30 and 40 years ago. Now these people have a million people watching them on YouTube. So what impact does that have on people who are perhaps tipping into psychosis?
And shortly after the two of you presented your ideas to some of your colleagues, a Canadian journalist working for the National Post called you. How did he present the story?
Well, he presented it in some of the same terms that we've been using. He was interested in the idea that some aspect of culture, like a film, could actually tip people over into madness. At the time.
But my question earlier was, did it tip people into madness, or would they have just found some other inspiration?
Well, as I say, we really don't know at this stage. I mean, one of the things that we try to do in the book is make a case for the seriousness of the question, mind you, just the question that culture and other aspects of the environment could tip you over into madness. We don't have the data yet, but here's the kind of case we make. Suppose two twins, identical twins, are highly vulnerable genetically to lung cancer. One of them moves to New York and one of them moves to Burlington. And because the air is dirty in New York, one of them develops, that twin develops lung cancer but not the other. That's a case where environment tips one over into illness. If it's true, as we think it is, that the environment can be pathogenic, can contribute to illness, then imagine two twins, again, one raised in New York and one raised in Burlington. The twin in New York is surrounded by a lot of strangers, and we know that that's pathogenic for schizophrenia. So it's possible that the environment can tip someone into illness who would not otherwise become ill, but we just don't have the data.
Are we back in that old nature versus nurture debate?
No, I think we're beyond that, and I think the science has shown us how to go beyond that. I think what we now believe, certainly in the psychosis and schizophrenia literature, I think what we now believe is that illness comes about as a result of a very complex interplay between genetic vulnerabilities, events during early childhood, other life events, and then subsequent stressors. So there's a very complicated biology environment story that we have to trace out.
Joel, when after that first article in the National Post, there were more and more media coverage. There was more media coverage. Were you surprised by the attention it was receiving?
Not particularly. Once it got out, there's a certain sexy and not very deep idea that people have. The instance of the journalist who calls and says, oh, just that, I guess watching, you know, The Real Housewives of Des Moines will make us all crazy. And they just wanted a quick answer. We didn't have these kinds of conversations. And we were sort of punchlines, little snippets that they can put online. And
well, after watching The Real Housewives of Des Moines, I had this terrible fantasy that I had moved to Iowa.
Well, I won't suggest that you have any mental illness in that respect. So that's one of the things that drove Ian and I to want to write the book, because we realized how much misinformation was out there, how people were not taking the Truman Show delusion and, frankly, other forms of delusion seriously. It was more a sense of almost poking fun at these individuals who were not narcissistic. They were not people who wanted to be seen by the whole world. They wanted nothing more than to be left alone by the whole world, and they suffered tremendously.
My guests are Dr. Joel Gold of the NYU School of Medicine and Ian Gold of McGill University. They have collaborated on a book called Suspicious Minds, How Culture Shapes Madness, The Truman Show Delusion and Other Strange Beliefs. What other types of strange beliefs have you encountered in your work, Joel?
You name it. We've probably treated it at Bellevue, though Ian and I have a sense that all delusions essentially are social in nature, if one boils them down. In a sense, you know, people don't have delusions about the furniture, the wallpaper, what have you. They have delusions about other people primarily. And there we figure about 12 forms of delusion. The contents of those delusions can shift from culture to culture and from time to time, era to era.
Because obviously there are people in other parts of the world who are delusional who have never even had the Truman Show distributed or exhibited in their town.
Of course. And someone who might think that they are Jesus here might think that they're the Buddha in Asia.
But isn't that called schizophrenia?
It really depends on whether we think that they meet the criteria, although that gets into the whole DSM issue, which maybe we'll leave for another time. It does become complicated what you really think about it. But they're suffering. They're sick.
Ian, how has our understanding of madness changed? What did John Locke attribute to our understanding of madness?
Well, John Locke, the great empiricist philosopher, is really the person who first introduced the idea that madness is a problem of ideas. Strangely enough, the standard accounts of madness that go right back to the beginning of civilizations really fall into two categories. Either madness had something to do with the gods, a punishment, say, from the gods, and we see that in the Bible and in Greek drama, or it was a bodily problem. So the Greeks also gave us, in effect, a physical theory of madness. The Greeks thought it was it was the humors that were out of balance, the fluids in our bodies. But other other Greek thinkers, like Hippocrates, thought that madness was a brain problem, just as we do now. With Locke, what we see is madness, the theory of madness, turning towards problems of thinking, and that's where we get the idea that the madman is irrational, not just sick, not just tormented by the gods, but his thinking has gone awry.
In your research, did you come across the Martha Mitchell syndrome?
No, I didn't. I don't know anything about it.
The doctors diagnose patients as delusional, but in reality, the symptoms are actually real.
Oh, I see. Well, there is controversy in some places, as there is in any science. The one that we come across a lot actually has to do with delusions of what are called parasitosis. There are people who believe their skin is infested with parasites, and this is sometimes clearly delusional. There's a disorder called Morgellons disease, though, which is thought to be by some people thought to be a form of delusional parasitosis, but by other people thought to be a new skin disease, and no one's described it yet. So there's an example of a controversy where we're going to have to wait and see what the science tells us.
Joel?
It's interesting when you look at DSM. DSM-4 states that delusions are false beliefs, and now they've moved on to DSM-5 where they don't have to be false, and that's kind of important. You can imagine someone, in the book we describe a woman who is paraplegic and can't get out of bed, and yet her husband is convinced that she's having an affair. It's pretty clear that he is delusional, but in other cases, the person who's delusional and has that sense that their partner is cheating on them for reasons that are clearly delusional. My neighbor is wearing a red tie, my wife is wearing a red dress, so they're obviously having an affair. Yet it doesn't mean that she's not having an affair. She may well be. So the idea that it's by definition false is something that we need to look at, particularly again with the surveillance society that we live in today.
The DSM has gone through 5 revisions, and in the past it has reflected changes in our culture's attitude about various things. For example, homosexuality was treated, described as an illness through a number of the early versions of the DSM.
Until 1980, yeah.
So how does, in the end, can the DSM be harmful in trying to deal with some of these things? Because if you were following it in an earlier version, you probably would be approaching these patients differently.
Absolutely. Harmful, it's certainly not useful in a number of contexts. For one, before 1980, what they called schizophrenia likely was not schizophrenia. So when you hear historical accounts of people and they're considered schizophrenic, they probably weren't. And so what does that tell us about the people who were being treated and, you know, the conceptions of their illnesses back, 40 and 50 years ago?
Do you think, Ian, that our surveillance society is making some people more mentally ill?
Well, I don't know that we have any evidence for that. What we try to do is make a case that it's possible. And the case really looks at the phenomenon of delusion more broadly and the way in which the environment affects it. There's a lot of data that shows us that social facts do contribute to delusional thinking and to schizophrenia more broadly. We know that child abuse, that being an immigrant or the child of an immigrant, and that living in a big city are probably causally connected with the development of schizophrenia, which is the paradigm biological form of psychosis. So the idea that threatening environments could participate in psychosis is not really all that controversial. What's really interesting is the question of whether the cultural change we're undergoing right now is turning our environment into a more dangerous one.
A listener, Bob from Rego Park, asks, how would you distinguish a mystical experience or a divine revelation from a delusion?
That's a great question, and it's one that I've actually been thinking about. I'm doing some work now, and Joel and I have talked about this. I'm doing some work on what's called Jerusalem syndrome, which is a very rare delusional disorder in which pilgrims or tourists to Jerusalem can develop a psychotic illness. The pure form of Jerusalem syndrome is very rare, where people really have no history of illness and become ill in Jerusalem in the spirit, you know, in the atmosphere of the divine city. And I was talking to a psychiatrist who has treated many of these patients, Gregory Katz, who tells me that many of them, even when they're aware they've had an illness, still feel they've had an important religious experience. There's also a long tradition showing an overlap between strange mental illness and true religious experience, and it's very tough to know how to distinguish them. I think what Joel was saying about having to tease apart what's real and what's delusional is complicated, and that's why we need psychiatrists.
Now, what about conspiracy theories and things of that sort? Some of them can seem rather off the wall, and yet are they delusional?
Well, you know, as we write in the book, if you think that you've been abducted by aliens and taken to another planet and
or on a spaceship and,
yes.
and examined. Many people have this feeling
Absolutely.
That they've been physically examined by aliens and UFOs.
Absolutely. And one who has that belief is likely to be deemed psychotic, but if one believes that others have had that experience, then they're not deemed to be psychotic. They have an idea that many people undergo this, but it's not in and of itself delusional. And what does that really tell us?
Did the UFO delusion come from science fiction films? Or the popularity of science fiction?
Again, this is
the... Can we blame L. Ron Hubbard for this too?
Well, I'm not going to get into L. Ron Hubbard. I want to keep my health. Point being that there are certain forms, again, of illness, as Ian said, and as things move forward, the UFOs fill in that space. So if you watch Invasion of the Body Snatchers, then that's obviously going to have quite an impact. And today, you know, it's the Truman Show.
Well, in the case of Invasion of the Body Snatchers, it's a very great film, very effective. I suspect that there are some films that look kind of stupid that would have less of an impact. Tomato, what was that film called about the invasion?
Plan 9 from Outer Space, yeah. Perhaps.
Now, Ian, Edward Hagen has developed a theory about the question of whether delusions are an evolutionary adaptation. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, this is a view that we've been, you know, that we've been much influenced by and much admire. So Edward's got the view that in evolutionary history, it would have been very important to maintain certain social ties. And what he thinks is that a certain subset of delusions are evolutionarily developed strategies that the mind came up with, unconscious strategies, for reinstituting ties. So here's an example. Suppose that you've been isolated socially, you've been alienated for some reason, people don't get on with you. If you develop the delusion that other people are out to get you, and you can convince your neighbors and your friends that you're in danger, you might invite them to help you, right? So you might invite them to reinstitute social ties. And so for him, delusions are strategies for fixing social problems that you already have. Now, we very much like this view. I like the strategy that he adopts. I like the evolutionary approach. And we've, as I say, we've been influenced by this view. I think where the view doesn't quite work is that it predicts that delusion should be very common, because if they're successful strategies for repairing social problems, then they should be common. But of course, they're not.
What role do stress and anxiety play in all of this, Joel?
I think stress and anxiety is a good connector between patient and doctor. The therapeutic alliance, the relationship between the patient and the doctor, is really the foundation of any successful therapy. So while someone with a delusion like this is not going to believe anything I have to say, at least at first, I'm just an actor in their film, if we can focus on their experience of anxiety, how must it feel to have the government follow you, to have cameras everywhere? And that may be an entree for me to make a connection to the patient.
But you're suggesting that for somebody who's delusional, the doctor is also part of the whole plot.
In Truman Show Delusion, the entire world, including family members, are in on it.
Can changing one's social life decrease the chance of developing psychosis?
It's a really interesting question in terms of what Ian said earlier. You know, obviously, if you have a genetic predisposition to lung cancer, smoking's probably not a great idea. But if you think, or if you know that you have a genetic predisposition to schizophrenia, would you perhaps move to a bucolic town? Most people would not do that, but it's an interesting thought experiment at the very least.
In a certain sense, in the age of social media, don't we all sort of live in a Truman Show that we are producing about ourselves?
I think that's exactly right, and I think we're only just beginning to realize that. We're living in a world where lots and lots of people can be watching us, and we can be watching lots and lots of other people in turn. And for those of us of a certain age, I mean, I'm 52, this is something that we see in our kids and have no idea how to make sense of it. So I think part of what we try to do in our book is make a case that we ought to be thinking a bit about this. There is already some data showing psychological changes and even brain changes associated, not causally necessarily, but correlated with internet use. And we think this is something that psychiatry needs to look into.
Joel, while you were writing this book, you checked in on your first Truman Show patients. How are they doing? Have their delusions persisted?
The ones that I was able to connect with are mostly doing better, some much better. I've become quite close to one gentleman who's the only guy who is not disguised in the book, Kevin Hall. I was not initially treating him, but he reached out to me. He is a former American Olympian. He has survived testicular cancer, and he suffers from bipolar disorder. And when he has an episode, he has Truman Show delusion, and he is able to describe it with a lot of real detail and passion. And some of the other guys have done less well. It really depends on the diagnosis.
Does it matter whether the film is 3D? Would Edge of Tomorrow have created new delusions?
I couldn't speak to it. I have not seen the film, but I don't think that's something we have to worry about too much.
Ian, just one more question. Have you met opposition to these ideas from colleagues?
I wouldn't say so. In fact, if anything, we've had colleagues periodically call us up, even me, and I'm not a practicing psychiatrist. I've had colleagues in psychiatry let me know that they've had patients like this, too, now, and occasionally ask me for advice, which I think is astonishing as a philosopher who is constantly told that what he does has no practical value. It's a great pleasure to have colleagues ask me questions about this.
Ian Gold, Joel Gold, their book Suspicious Minds, How Culture Shapes Madness, The Truman Show Delusion and Other Strange Beliefs. It is published by Free Press. Thank you both so much for being on our show.
It's been
wonderful.
A pleasure.
Thank you so much.